Isaiah 40 is one of the Bible's great chapters. It describes, as many of you know, the sheer immensity of Yahweh and the laughable smallness of all created things compared to the great eternal God. And one of the things then depicted as laughably small in that chapter is the nations. Isaiah 40 verse 15, behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are accounted as the dust on the scales. And then a couple of verses later, all the nations are as nothing before him. They are accounted by him as less than nothing and emptiness. And I mention that then because that spirit of Isaiah 40 can be detected, I think, here in Daniel chapter 5. Look at the last two verses of this chapter where we read, that very night Belshazzar the Chaldean king was killed and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now, do you notice anything odd about that? One king, we're told, departs, who is a Chaldean. Another king replaces him, who is a Mede. In other words, this is not simply a change of monarch we're dealing with here. This is a change of empire, and a particularly momentous change of empire at that. Chaldean, as you know, is another word for Babylonian. And so the outgoing empire here, the empire that is reaching its expiry date and biting the dust, is none other than the Babylonian Empire, one of the greatest global powers in the whole of human history. Now, you would have thought, wouldn't you, that a development of that magnitude would leave a significant mark on this book of Daniel. This book, after all, is from that historical period. Surely then it will analyze in detail this seismic event that is taking place. But it doesn't. Just two measly verses reporting the transition in the most matter-of-fact way. Because you see, it's the perspective of Isaiah 40 that we have here. Yes, Babylon might have been a big deal in its own eyes. And yes, Babylon might have been a big deal in the perception of most of the world of the time. And yes, Babylon might be a big deal in the history books and in the displays that you can see at the British Museum today, but it isn't a big deal to Yahweh. To him, Babylon is a little water droplet. It's a little speck of dust whose rise and fall is neither here nor there. And so, yes, Daniel 5 will give a concluding nod to the fact of Babylon's demise, but it won't make that its main concern. It won't get bogged down in intricate political analysis. Chapter 5 is instead preoccupied with far more important and profitable themes, and three themes in particular that I want us to focus on this evening. And first of all then, God's intolerance. God's intolerance. Now, if you have some knowledge of the Old Testament, you might find the first few verses of our chapter ring some bells in your head, that they evoke a certain sense of déjà vu, perhaps. Why is that? To what do these verses bear some passing resemblance? Well, they bear some resemblance to Esther chapter 1. In both passages, we have a king hosting a great banquet. In Esther 1, it's King Ahasuerus. Here in Daniel 5, of course, it's King Belshazzar. Both passages involve the abundant flow of wine. And in both passages, the king ends up issuing a foolish command. In Esther 1, it's the command that Queen Vashti should be brought to the banquet so that the revelers might enjoy her physical beauty. Here in Daniel 5, it's the command that the articles plundered from the Jerusalem temple at the time of Judah's deportation should be brought to this banquet so that the revelers might drink from those articles from those vessels. And so there are those similarities then that you can see, I hope, between Esther 1 and Daniel 5. But, of course, the foolish commands having been issued in both cases, and the foolish commands having been implemented in both cases, the two scenes then take divergent paths, don't they? In Esther 1, remember, Queen Vashti refuses to come to the banquet. The king is furious. He divorces her, and so the search now begins for a new queen, which is how Esther is suddenly thrown into center stage. And so it's a hugely significant sequence of events, but it's a natural as opposed to a supernatural sequence of events. We're within the realm of the normal there in Esther chapter 1. In Daniel 5, on the other hand, what happens next is anything but natural and normal. There's this highly supernatural intervention. The fingers of a human hand suddenly appearing on the wall of the banqueting hall and writing this unintelligible message. And it raises the question then, why the divergence? Why do events take this more mind-blowing course here in Daniel chapter 5? Well, at one level, of course, we can answer that God is free to respond to situations however he wants to respond. He isn't bound to work in the same way in Daniel 5 as he does in Esther 1. But at another level, I think the answer is this. Belshazzar's foolishness is on an altogether higher plane than Ahasuerus's foolishness. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not condoning the latter's actions. He failed his poor wife badly when seeking to turn her into this object of gratification for his dinner guests. But Belshazzar's crime here is different. He isn't being a lousy husband. He is engaging in out and out blasphemy. I mean, verse 3 here is bad enough, isn't it? Drinking from Yahweh's holy vessels at this rowdy banquet. If he were just using these cups from Yahweh's temple just for a secular banquet, in itself, that's bad enough, I'm saying. But then, of course, verse 4 goes further. Drinking from Yahweh's holy vessels while worshipping pagan gods. I mean, this is an explicit put-down to the God of Israel. It's a statement that Yahweh is just a small, inconsequential God who must yield his temple vessels to the worship of greater gods than he. That's the statement that's been made here. And so I'm saying the way more serious nature of Belshazzar's foolishness explains the divergence from Esther chapter 1. In fact, I'd put it to you that as Esther chapter 1 is kind of left behind here, there's another Old Testament scene that starts to provide a closer comparison, one that we've actually looked at together fairly recently. I'm thinking of Judges chapter 16. And in Judges 16, like in Daniel 5, Yahweh has allowed his people's enemy to get the upper hand on his people. In this case, the enemy isn't the Babylonians, the enemy is the Philistines. And they have Israel within their grip, and they've now even captured and humiliated Israel's champion, Samson. And the Philistines then might have retained that upper hand over Israel had they not done something extremely foolish. Remember how they attributed Samson's capture to their god, Dagon. And they organized this great worship service to parade the fact and celebrate the fact that Dagon had intervened and Dagon had triumphed and Dagon had given Samson into their hands. And this was just a step too far for the watching Yahweh. The Philistines crossed a line that night in their temple. He couldn't tolerate such blasphemy. And so he interrupts the worship service, giving Samson one last bout of strength and bringing Dagon's temple crashing down on those blasphemous Philistines. And here likewise then, Belshazzar takes a step too far for the watching Yahweh. He crosses a line, and Yahweh cannot tolerate this blasphemy. And so he interrupts the banquet, not by bringing the building down, but by the fingers of this hand appearing and writing this message. And so that's what I mean then by God's intolerance. God is jealous for his own glory and won't ultimately tolerate blasphemous defiance. As he puts it in Isaiah, I will not give my glory to another. I will not give my glory to these gods of stone and wood and gold and silver who are being elevated above me in that banqueting hall. And by the way, it's not a distasteful and an unattractive trait of Yahweh when we see him in the scriptures being jealous like this for his own glory. The point is that God is so objectively glorious, it is only right that he himself should be jealous for the recognition of that glory. If he were not, then he would be sinning. If you're an official GCSE marker and all these papers come across your desk and you're marking them all, and then, I know it's a far-fetched story, but then your son's exam paper in maths or English or whatever it might be comes across your desk, and it's brilliant, and he's answered everything absolutely perfectly, then it wouldn't be right for you to say, well, he's my son, so I better just give him 65% here. No, it's only right. You'd be doing wrong in that case. It's only right that the objectiveness of the perfection of that exam paper be recognized by you yourself, and you give that paper 100% even though it's your son's paper. And similarly, it's only right for God himself to recognize the objective perfection of his own glory. If he did not do that, he would be blaspheming himself. He would be sinning. And so it's not an unattractive thing, but a right and a proper and an appropriate thing when we see the God of the Bible being so jealous for the recognition of his glory. And in fact, I want to go further and say this, that at the end of the day, our salvation depends upon this divine intolerance. On Christmas morning, I preached on Genesis 3:15. And I think I mentioned in passing, but didn't really stress, what is in fact the most important thing of all about Genesis 3:15. That while we call it the first gospel promise, it's not really a promise at all. It's a threat, isn't it? It's not spoken to Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve, I'm going to send a savior for you. It's spoken to the serpent. I'm going to send a champion who will smash you to pieces. And it means then that God's fundamental agenda in sending Jesus, according to that seminal gospel statement that sets the trajectory for the rest of Scripture, God's fundamental agenda in sending Jesus is to deal with this blasphemous upstart who has just invaded his creation and assaulted his glory. That's God's fundamental agenda. And the salvation of human beings will be a byproduct of that. I know that's not the whole story, and we can go to texts that explain our salvation in terms of God's love for us, and we can sing, because my Saviour loves me so, he will hold me fast, and that's appropriate and legitimate and good theology. God loves us and so sent his Son for us, that's true. But nonetheless, when you go back to the very foundation, the foundational statement of our salvation in Genesis 3:15, what do you find? You find that God's primary agenda in this whole business is driving out of his creation this intruder who has dared to blaspheme him and has dared to assault his glory. So thank God, I'm saying, that he's intolerant. Thank God that he's jealous for his glory. Thank God that he didn't in Eden shrug his shoulders and say, oh, whatever, Satan might have done this, who cares? Thank God that he said, I am going to smash your skull to pieces, because in the smashing of Satan's skull to pieces resides our salvation. And so that's the first thing to notice this evening, God's intolerance. Secondly, notice with me Daniel's rise. Daniel's rise. And I mean the way then that Daniel, in the second half of our passage, comes to the fore and rises to this position of great honor. Now, it might seem strange for me to be saying that. Surely we've been here before. Surely Daniel doesn't need to rise. Surely Daniel can't rise because Daniel's already at the top. Haven't we seen him rise to that position already? Well, yes, we have. But we need to appreciate that we've jumped forward now, some 25 years probably. And clearly then, during that quarter of a century that has passed, Daniel has been somewhat forgotten. Indeed, I think there are indications in the text that Belshazzar has quite deliberately forgotten and sidelined Daniel. I mean, it's interesting that after the miracle with the hand has occurred and Belshazzar is in this state of meltdown, the queen steps in. Now, almost certainly the ESV footnote is correct, and it's the queen mother rather than the queen. I've already mentioned this evening Vashti there in the book of Esther. That's roughly, of course, the same period and the same part of the world that we're talking about. And the way then that she could be summoned like she was by her husband Ahasuerus, and the way in which her refusal to comply caused such an outrage throughout the kingdom, that kind of indicates the status that queens had in that setting. The queen mother, on the other hand, would have had a much higher status. And it's likely then that this woman who takes the initiative at this point and steps into the banqueting hall and delivers this speech, it's likely that she is the queen mother rather than the queen. And as then she tells Belshazzar of Daniel, it seems, doesn't it, like she's kind of introducing Belshazzar to a figure that he will never have heard of. I mean, that's, if you just had the queen mother's speech, that's how you would take it, that, you know, this is some figure from way back in the past, because she's the queen mother, she's of an older generation, and she remembers Daniel, but Belshazzar won't have heard of Daniel, and so she's kind of introducing Belshazzar to Daniel. But in actual fact, we discover later that's not the case, because when Daniel comes in and addresses Belshazzar in verses 17 to 28, he talks first of all, doesn't he, about what had happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Now, by the way, he keeps referring to Nebuchadnezzar. The passage keeps referring to Nebuchadnezzar as Belshazzar's father. Again, the footnote reading is probably correct. In fact, it's certainly correct that Belshazzar was his successor rather than his son. And that this was just a way then that the language that would have been used of a successor, that he was son of the king, even if he wasn't actually the son of the king. And Nebuchadnezzar was a few kings back and wasn't actually related to Belshazzar at all, because there'd been an assassination in between. And so Nebuchadnezzar wasn't Belshazzar's father. He was a predecessor. But it's interesting then that Daniel talks about what had happened to him, to Nebuchadnezzar, as I say, about 25 years earlier. And about the way that he had been so humbled and driven out with the animals and all the rest of it. And then he says, and this is interesting in verse 22, "You, his son, successor, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this." Though you knew all this. In other words, Belshazzar was no ignoramus when it came to recent Babylonian history. He knew the story of Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation. And he must, therefore, if he knew the story of Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation, he must have known about Daniel's role in the whole thing, because that role was so integral. And clearly then, if Daniel has receded completely into the background, if Daniel no longer is pacing the corridors of power, then that is Belshazzar's choice. Belshazzar has deliberately forgotten and sidelined this man he must have known about. And I think on top of that, there are other hints. I mean, when Belshazzar addresses Daniel in verses 13 to 16, his disdain for Daniel is only very thinly veiled. So verse 13, at the start of the speech, he seems very keen to put Daniel in his place, doesn't he? "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah." Not "you are that Daniel who once was one of the top men in this land, but you're just one of the exiles who came here in chains years ago because one of my predecessors had conquered your land." He's really trying to put Daniel in his place. And then just the way he says twice in verse 14 and in verse 16, "I have heard that you can interpret dreams," and all the rest of it. Not, I think you're just the man to help me in this situation, but I've heard there's a report about this, but I'm not convinced, the jury's still out. That's the impression that he's given to Daniel. And again, that word "if" in the middle of verse 16, "now if you can read the writing." He's not sure Daniel's going to be up to this. But, if you can, then you'll be appropriately rewarded. And so again, it suggests that Daniel's background role now in Babylon is because Belshazzar doesn't like him. And so just think then of the relative situations of these two men at the start of this banquet in Daniel 5. I mean, we're kind of encouraged almost, aren't we, to set these two men alongside each other, because they have very similar names, Belshazzar and Belteshazzar, the Babylonian name that Daniel has. And so it's natural to kind of compare and contrast them, to set them alongside each other. And that's what I want us to do for a moment. And just think about these two men then, pre the banquet. And on the one hand, then you have Belshazzar, and he's on top of the world, isn't he? He's this powerful, powerful king who's able to summon 1,000 lords to a great feast and able to wine and dine all of them richly. He's riding the crest of a wave. He's a big, big man, is Belshazzar. Daniel, on the other hand, he's a discarded, forgotten man. He's just one of the exiles, as Belshazzar calls him. But then you fast forward a few hours, And what a change. The formerly discarded Daniel is pronouncing Belshazzar's doom and then assuming royal status as Belshazzar is being swept into history's dustbin. And what are we to make of this then? Is anything more going on here than just a nice little story of one man and a reversal of his fortunes? Well, I suppose if the book of Daniel were just a self-standing book, or indeed if the Bible were, to again use that phrase I used in my prayer, if the Bible were just an anthology of tales, then we might say, yes, it's just a nice story of one man's reversal of fortunes. Daniel here rising from being discarded to being honoured. And it's a bit like Joseph and the way he rose from being discarded to being honoured as well. And the Bible has these nice little stories to encourage us and make us feel a bit better when we're finding life tough, and give us a bit of hope that we might also rise like they did when we're being forgotten about and when we're being mistreated. But of course, the story of Joseph and the story of Daniel, they're not self-standing, are they? They're part of one bigger story. And that bigger story is all about one person. And it's not Joseph and it's not Daniel. Joseph's role and Daniel's role is to point to the one person that the whole story is really about. And that one person is, of course, Jesus. And centuries later than our story here, he will be another despised Jew. We heard at the start of our service tonight about that day when the rulers of this age took nails and pinned him to a cross outside Jerusalem, discarded him, abandoned him. And the rulers of this age went to their plush homes that Friday evening. And they thought they'd done a good job and they'd written off Jesus and they'd finished him and they'd gotten rid of him. And yet those rulers of this age hadn't seen the back of the Jew they'd discarded. And the Bible is full of passages indicating that one day that discarded Jew of Calvary will pronounce the doom of those rulers of this age. And he will reign forever while they are swept away into the abyss of hell. And does this then have any relevance to us this evening? Well, let me put it this way. There are many still who discard and disdain Jesus. Many in our world who are on the same page as Belshazzar with Jesus in miniature, Daniel. And on the same page as those rulers of this age in first century Jerusalem. Many who hate Jesus and curse Jesus and have no time for Jesus. And it seems like that rejection of him has no consequence whatsoever, but the Bible indicates that a day is coming when that Jesus that they and perhaps you have rejected, are rejecting, when that Jesus will pronounce your doom and he will reign forever while you receive everlasting damnation. And so my warning to you is quit the rejection of Jesus. Move away from Belshazzar and the rulers of this age in Jerusalem and worship the Jesus rejected at Calvary, who has risen and who is rising and increasing constantly and who will reign forevermore. Don't be a Belshazzar, but come and embrace Jesus Christ. He will win. He will win. Daniel could not be kept down. Jesus cannot either. So we've seen then God's intolerance, Daniel's rise. Just thirdly and finally tonight, Belshazzar's problem. Belshazzar's problem. So the writing on the wall then, it tells Belshazzar three things, doesn't it? And really then it's the second of the three items that is his real problem. I mean, the first and the third are devastating in terms of his career and his historical legacy and all the rest of it. So the first, according to the first item then, the days of his kingdom are coming to an end. So as I say, at the career level, devastating. At the third item, your kingdom is divided, verse 27, and given to the Medes and Persians. Again, in terms of his career and legacy, devastating. But they both pale into insignificance alongside the second item. The first half of verse 27, Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. That, I'm saying, is Belshazzar's real problem. And it's also your real problem and mine. And tomorrow, your career might go pear-shaped. And tomorrow, your health might take a real blow. And tomorrow, all kinds of disasters might befall your life. But your real problem is this, that there is a God to whom you are accountable, a God who will weigh you. Weigh your life, weigh your conduct, weigh the way that you have lived. And inevitably you will be found wanting. If only we could all see clearly that that is our fundamental problem. It's interesting, isn't it, that here there's such a foolish inability to recognize the scale of this problem with Belshazzar and the Babylonians. It's interesting how, and this is a bit like earlier on with Nebuchadnezzar, how Belshazzar panics, doesn't he, when the writing appears on the wall. And he, as I said a moment ago, he's in a state of meltdown. He's really in a state of complete agitation and panic. But the whole thing that seems to be causing the panic is the unintelligibleness of the writing. And I mean, the Queen Mother, when she comes in, she says, doesn't she, O King, live forever, let not your thoughts alarm you or your colour change. And she's saying, because there's someone who will be able to interpret, as if as long as the message can be interpreted, then there's no reason to panic. Whereas in fact, of course, it's once the message has been interpreted that really Belshazzar should be panicking. Because of the nature of the message. It's like Nebuchadnezzar, and he sees that vision of the great statue, and the statue being smashed to pieces. And he, like Belshazzar, is panicking about this. And then Daniel comes along and makes it known to him, and he seems to have the attitude, oh, now I know, that's fine. Even though the content of the vision is so devastating. And similarly here, Belshazzar, once he knows what it says, he seems fine and he hands out all these rewards to Daniel. And he's so stupid. It's now that he knows that there's a God in heaven who is weighing him in the balances and finding him wanting. It's then that his knees should start knocking and his colour should change. But there just seems to be this blindness, this foolishness, whereby all that matters to Babylonians is knowing what things mean. And as long as they know what things mean, they don't care what the content is. And however personally devastating it might be. And I'm saying, do you see clearly tonight what they couldn't see? That this is massive, that this is your biggest problem, that there is a God who weighs you. And what should you do about that? Should you resolve to work harder, be better? Produce good works in your lives that will be heavy and will register well on the divine scales? Well, no, it won't be to any avail. With all our good works, we'll all be found wanting. We cannot register sufficient weight by being good that God will let us into heaven. What then? Well, let me take you again one more time to Calvary, to that cross outside Jerusalem. And remember how Jesus hangs on that cross for those several hours. As he does so, he says several things, doesn't he? There's one very interesting thing he says that perhaps we don't often pay much attention to, and it's right toward the end. It's only Luke who tells us about this. And just as he's about to die, remember how he says to God, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And partly, yes, it's just an indication of the peacefulness in which Jesus is now dying. He's borne the wrath. He's been forsaken. And now he can call God his Father again and commit his spirit into his Father's hands. But I think there's more going on than that. That Jesus is saying, "Father, I'm committing my life to you now. This obedience I've rendered over these last 33 years, climaxing here on this day at Calvary, I'm putting that into your hands, and so that you can examine it, Father, so that you can scrutinize it, Father, so that you can weigh it in your scales, Father, and see whether my obedience is good enough, Father." And that's what he says. And then he breathes his last. And then the world waits. And he's buried. And the silence. And the world waits. And the world waits. And then Sunday morning comes. And the tomb is opened. And God brings Jesus back out. And Paul tells us in 2 Timothy 3 that that was his vindication. And in that moment, the Father was saying, "Son, I've weighed your life in my scales. I've weighed your obedience, and I've not found it wanting. I found it perfect. It registers perfectly on my scales. And so I'm vindicating you, and I'm bringing you out." And Jesus then is the only person in history of whom that can be said. The only one who could put his life into God's scales and it weighs heavily enough. And so what we need tonight is not to say, "I need to do better. I need to find some more weight to bring up the weight on God's scales." What we need to do is go to Jesus. And we need to believe in him. And in believing in him, we're joined to him. And being joined to him, his obedience becomes our obedience. And his perfect weight on God's scales becomes our perfect weight on God's scales. And God can then say of each of us, "I have weighed you in my scales and not found you wanting." Is that true of you tonight? Forget trying to be good. Forget trying to earn the right weight on God's scales. Come to the one who has been vindicated. Come and believe in Jesus. Amen.